I was part of this community. I was there for 12 years before I got branded.
Sarah Edmondson is a acclaimed actress and voice artist. She's also a cult buster.
One of the lies was like, you make a lot of money. And truthfully, I did make a lot of money compared to most people. But that was something that was very rare. Most people did not. And they used me as like a bait for other people. Because not even so much, is this a cult or not a cult? Don't worry about that. Let's get the word out of the way. Is this thing, this program, this group, this family, this club, this whatever, is it healthy for me? Can I leave? Can I leave without being shunned? Am I still going to be friends with the people, or are they not going to talk to me on the street? Like, that's a huge red flag.
You're listening to the Real Business Connections Network.
Real Business Connections Network.
Powered by Balbert Marketing, LLC. Subscribe now and check us out at realbusinessconnections.com. Enjoy the show.
Welcome, everyone, once again to Learn, Speak, Teach on the Real Business Connections Network. I'm here today with the lovely Sarah Edmondson. Sarah, what's happening? How are you?
I'm 98%. I'm good. I'm glad to be here. Just recovering from something, but I'm here for it, whatever it may be.
Hey, I'm blessed and honored that you took the time, even though you're feeling a little bit sick. And I've been binging you and your husband Nippy's podcast for the past like 6 months. So I've been looking forward to this one. Yeah. I'm on, let's see, season 5, episode 12.
Which one's that? I don't know the numbers.
I don't know which one it is. I was just pointing out the fact that I started from zero and I'm all the way to season five. Yeah.
Amazing.
That's how you're supposed to do it, right?
That's great. What are you learning? Let me ask. I'm flipping the script. What did you learn from our podcast?
Well, and it's funny because we haven't even gotten into the bio, but we'll do that in a second. Your podcast is a little bit culty, and what I'm learning is the human behavior and social dynamics, whether it's love bombing or gaslighting, or just the pressure placed on teammates to conform to certain tribal standards within a culture, is massively pervasive across the board, not just in cults. And I'm starting to notice it more than I ever could imagine.
That's awesome. I feel like that's mission accomplished, that you're getting.
So to bring everybody into the conversation, Sarah Edmondson is a acclaimed actress and voice artist. She's also a cult buster. She was featured on the cover of the New York Times as a whistleblower exposing the cult Nexium. And she chronicled that experience in her memoir, Scarred, which I read that as well. It was fantastic. And currently co-hosts a podcast, A Little Bit Culty, with her husband, Nippy. In addition, their journey escaping Nexium was documented in the HBO hit docuseries, The Vow. And I'm just super excited. By chance, I did not do this on purpose. I was in Albany, New York yesterday.
No way.
Yeah.
What are you doing there?
I host a LinkedIn Live with a few people, and they live in the Albany area, and I hadn't met them in person yet. So I just came to say hello. What? Why is Albany? We're not going to give the whole stories because you wrote an entire book. You're on the New York Times. The docuseries, The Vow, is incredible. So I want to get in things that aren't there, but to bring people up, like, well, what's the significance of Albany, New York? Let's start there.
We'll start there. So I was a part of a personal, what we thought was a personal and professional development program, which, sidebar, had I met you 10, 15 years ago and been invited to this podcast, I would have been super excited because your audience would have actually been like our exact clientele. People who were in business, who wanted to learn and grow, wanted to develop themselves and be the best versions of themselves and expand their whatever it is that they were working on. So I was part of this community. I joined in 2005, and it was similar to a franchise where there are centers around the world. I ended up opening the first one in Canada. But before that, the main center, we called it the mothership, like that's not a red flag, was in Albany, New York. And I attended trainings there. I came out almost once a quarter at certain points, sometimes even more than that. for different workshops, trainings, seminars, meetings. And yeah, I had a real love hate with Albany. There's parts of it that I find really beautiful, like Saratoga, which is not Albany, obviously, like the region, upstate New York and Hudson and Troy, like nearby, beautiful. Me and my husband have a son named Troy, who is actually named after partly that region, also Troy Aikman, which is I'll let you dig into when you speak to Nippy later. But yeah, and then the hate part of it was that I always did not enjoy going there. And I never really knew why. I kind of thought it was maybe too suburban for me or something. Like, but there was something ick about it. But turned out it wasn't so much the city, but Keith Raniere himself, who is the leader. If people have been living under a rock and not heard about Nexium. Nexium's the name of the company overall. But when we joined, it was Executive Success Programs, or ESP. Keith Raniere created this, and he was the philosophical founder, aka the Vanguard, another red flag. And he was permitted up in a little enclave in upstate New York called Clifton Park, which is part of Albany. So that's my connection there. I hope I never have to go back. I did have to go back actually last fall for a wedding in Hudson, and to fly through the Albany airport, and brought back a lot of memories.
And I love in your podcast, and first off, thank you for your vulnerability across the board in your podcast, in your book. And I love in your show that you guys do dive deep into like what got you into it. Because even just like hanging out, I am not drinking, but they're having a couple beers with people in Albany. There's this pervasive like thought that it's just a bunch of stupid, gullible people that show up and start having sex with each other, and they're getting branded. And I know it's a total freaking like place of ignorance, but I found myself defending you guys. Like, I don't think you understand how human behavior works. I don't think you understand what's going on here. Mm-hmm. But what is going on that people just don't seem to see what's happening? And they come to these massive generalizations that are things that happened, but it's not like you signed up for that.
Right. That's actually something I say a lot. I never signed up for that. I was there for 12 years before I got branded. If somebody had said to me, when they invited me to the program initially in 2005, would you like to do a personal and professional development program and look at your limiting beliefs? And in 12 years from now, have the leader's initials seared into your flesh in a secret group. I probably would have said no. In fact, I know I would have said no, because that's crazy. But in 12 years, there's a lot of grooming and indoctrination that can take place. And this is definitely something. I appreciate you having our back, by the way. And I'm also like totally used to it. But I feel like those tides are changing a little bit with things like The Vow and Holy Hell and Wild, Wild Country and Going Clear and all these incredible documentaries that are out there now about cults or mind control or indoctrination or coercive control or high control groups, whatever you want to call it. There's different terms in the space. But I think the main thing that people don't know is that it's in many cases, Nexium it's great because it brought a lot of this to the front, and people could look at it and learn from it. But it's also an extreme example of what goes on everywhere. And some things that might be more socially acceptable or normal, not that it's okay, but things like hazing in a fraternity or a sorority. People do all sorts of things they would never do otherwise to get their pledge or whatever it's called, to be part of the brotherhood or the sisterhood. Peer pressure is an example of that. You'd say like, why would they do that? Well, they want to fit in. They want to belong. And so that there's certain dynamics that are at play that are much more heightened as well in a group like Nexium, that start very slowly and follow almost like, you know, when a playbook. So when we interview people from other groups and they tell us how they got in and how they, you know, what they were signing up for was always something good, always something really beautiful. Like when you think about a sorority, like the good part of it, I'm signing up to be part of a sisterhood with a bunch of like-minded women who are going to be my teammates through this crazy journey called university. Like that's the good part of it. What's the bad part of it? Oof. I mean, we all have to look alike. We end up getting drunk. There's a terrible rape culture. There's a terrible hazing culture. There's all these terrible things. that are the underbelly of it. So, oh, I totally tangented. You asked me, what do people not understand? Oh, so with all of these groups that we've looked at with our guests, what draws people in is something that's really wonderful, whether it's a community or a yoga practice or a breath work practice or a goals program or a political activist group. The people are joining to be part of something, part of a mission. That is one part of it. And there has to be something good on the outside. So when you're having drinks with your buddies in Albany and like, oh, those stupid naive people branding and having sex with each other, we didn't be like, oh, let's sign up for this sex cult. No, we signed up for a goals program. We signed up for a tool set that would help us achieve our goals and bust through our limiting beliefs. That's like a really great thing. But with all of these things, there's the term bait and switch.
Mm-hmm. 100%.
Right. I'm saying it's one thing. It's actually another thing. Like you invited me to your podcast. There's no bait and switch. I'm invited to your podcast to talk about your podcast. Now, if this was actually a sales funnel for you to have me do your coaching program or something, that would be a bait and switch. There's like a lie there. Right. So in marketing and in sales, there's quite a bit of that, but in some ways it's more acceptable because it's like, hey, take my free online seminar and then join my coaching thing. And then like, it's sort of laid out for you, right? It's not hidden.
Mm-hmm.
All of these groups have a hidden agenda, and ultimately it's for the leader's power and control. And for them to say, I'm doing this to help you, come join this thing so you can work on your goals, but really the leader's extracting value from their followers for their own benefit, right? So you know that now. And that's another thing I'd say is that, like, from the perspective of somebody having a beer and looking and be like, oh, it's so dumb. Yeah, it looks, if I had just seen the vow, no, that's not true. The vow, I think, was really good at showing the journey.
Yeah.
It did justice. I think,
but if you were just to see the cover of the New York Times, not read the article, understand. Yeah.
If you just saw a couple of headlines, you'd be like, that's so dumb. And I actually recognize that. And I've talked about this publicly that, you know, in the Harvey Weinstein story broke and, you know, all the Me Too stuff happened. Had I not gone through my own experience of that, I would have been like, why did she go upstairs with him?
Right.
Why wouldn't she just leave? No, it doesn't work like that. There's so many factors at play, and I'm sorry, I'm tangenting all over the place.
Please.
I blame the Robitussin. my mind is a little tripped out, but the template is really the same in all the groups, regardless of what it is that you're signing up for. So I mentioned all those things.
Yeah.
And one of the things is you are almost instantly love bombed. So all of these groups make you feel really special. Every single group I've ever talked to, especially in Christianity, we are the only true church, the chosen ones. We're the ones that have the direct line to God and the religious, in the religious cults, in personal development. Like we were Nexium, then there was Landmark. We're so much better than Landmark. We're so much better than Access Consciousness. We're so much better than Tony Robbins. Like, we are the only way to bust through limiting beliefs and evolve yourself, right? So you're not only do you feel loved and accepted and belonging and part of a community which appeals to a lot of people, myself included, and is a real drive, and we're special. And then you start to get isolated from the outside. So there's this us versus them mentality that occurs. Like and you see this right now so much in politics.
Mm.
It's so divided. It's the right and the left, the vax and the anti-vax, the red and the blue. It's like one or the other. It's binary. It's black and white. And black and white. Like, there's so many divisions, and each side thinks that the side is wrong and that side is right. So there's this righteousness.
Yeah.
So the more you go down the path and the more committed you are, and there's all these other things that happen, like you become more, you could become more dug in. So if if you really believe this and people around you are going, like, be careful, or that maybe even that's a cult, or like, you know, what are you up to? You have to be able to, like, no, this is a good thing. Like, I'm choosing this and I love this. And people tend to double down. Even if they start to see that, like, they're not getting their money's worth, they want to wait around to get their money's worth.
That's one thing.
Right? They're trying to get
curious about, because in a cult or even like a multi-level marketing structure where there's a lot of money to buy in possibly, and then a lot of work just to start recouping that money and gaining momentum, like it seems like a big financial risk. How did you feel taking a risk like that? Like you really thought that you, was it like the humanitarian perspective? Like, why was it worth to take that risk to kind of devote so much time to this kind of thing?
Well, it's interesting because I didn't start with that. I didn't start thinking I was taking a risk. I thought I was doing a personal development class for my own goals and to help with my relationship, the relationship I was in at the time. I wasn't like, you know, I'm going to devote my life to this.
Right.
That came later. And I think that came later as I got more invested. And there was part of me that was a little bit of a like, can I swear on this podcast?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. A little bit of like a fuck you to the naysayers. Like, I could do this. And almost like an individuation from my parents who are both in like my mom's a therapist, my dad's a retired counselor, no psychotherapist. This is like their field. And here I am going like, I found something better, guys. Like, how naive of me to think that it was better, but also a little so like so prideful to be like, this is, I have a short, basically it was a shortcut to therapy, I felt. Yeah. And I felt like therapy was a lot of talking and not actually getting anywhere. And we actually had the tools, the real tools. So in answer to your question, the investment. And also, okay, the other thing I'd say is the investment wasn't so, like, I didn't really understand how much I was investing. And it wasn't like, you know, invest $5,000 and then you're going to get this. It was like, it was a slow drip over time. And there came a point where I did want to open a center in Vancouver. And I didn't understand how bad their business model was. Like, anyone who's ever, and by the way, we were told it was not an MLM because MLMs are unethical and Keith is the most ethical man in the world. So it cannot be an MLM, which now I see does not make any sense. But I believed that it was not an MLM. It was a normal business structure. And anytime it's like questions about the business plan or the compensation plan and how we were getting paid, any sort of concern or negativity about that was always put back to me as my limitation, something I didn't understand or... You know, I put a lot of trust and faith that my leaders had my best interests in mind, but I did not. Nippy and I talk about this all the time. Yeah. We totally underestimated their capacity to lie to us. And they did. And one of the lies was like, you can make a lot of money. And truthfully, I did make a lot of money compared to most people. But that was something that was very rare. Most people did not. And they used me as like a bait for other people. Like if Sarah could do it, if Sarah can get out of her basement suite apartment and move into a condo, you know, you can too. And that was something that, you know, did motivate me for sure to be able to have a career where I could help people with their goals and make money. It was great. I for a couple of years there, I thought I had a dream job. It would have been a dream job, you know?
I even wrote this down, Sarah, from your book. Nancy said, if every city had a leader like Sarah, this company would be unstoppable.
Yep. Yeah, I forgot about that. She did say that.
It's
also making me feel special.
Yeah, I don't think there is anything culty about it, but I was at the Summit of Greatness. Lewis Howes, great podcaster, School of Greatness, puts on a summit, and I swear everybody that's a volunteer is like instructed and taught how to give the perfect high five, because I couldn't walk. I couldn't turn my body without getting high fived, and nothing wrong with that, but I felt the energy. And as someone who's kind of like a mellow dude, I'm like, what are these people on something? They seem like so energetic and happy to see me. And I'm just some random dude that they don't even know. And that's love bombing, right?
Yeah, I mean, if there was a hidden agenda, it would be love bombing.
I don't necessarily think there was a hidden agenda, but I feel what it felt like.
I don't think that. So love bombing to me has the connotation of manipulation.
Gotcha.
You know, like if there's like, we're going to make him feel good. Let's go out there and make him feel good and make all these new people feel good so that they blah, 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 blah.
Right.
that's kind of where it feels like love bombing. Because I think you can go to a party and feel good and feel accepted and feel like you're part of something, and it's not love bombing. It's just more about like, what's the intentions of the people doing it?
That makes sense.
Right?
So you can love on someone, build community, treat someone with love and respect, allow them to feel heard and seen and understood without an ulterior motive to use them as a pawn in your chess game.
Yes. And even still, like, I would say, you know, we didn't have the term love bombing when we were doing it, but we were like, you know, when we'd have an information night, we said, let's make sure there's lots of people there so people feel welcome. And people would come and they would go like, I don't know what it is that you're doing here, but I like it. Like, I like how I feel.
The vibe.
And so they'd sign up. Yeah, they liked the vibe. Some people didn't. And we'd be like, well, they're just not our people. That's okay. But that, I wasn't like trying to manipulate them. I was trying to show them the vibe of the community so that they'd come. So even still, for somebody like me, I had a positive intent. You know, I wanted to bring them into the fold, into team humanity. I just was wrong about the team. So I think that even still, like something that where you were just at, I don't know anything about the group.
Yeah.
People around you could have positive intentions and be really great people. Maybe the CEO of the company is back there, you know, doing something nefarious. I'm not saying that's the case, but like,
yeah,
you don't really know who's controlling the pocketbooks. You know what I mean? Like, where's the money go? I guess it's another question to ask always.
And in this specific example, definitely to my understanding, not the case. I just knew what it felt like to be in a community where everybody was just energetic and positive and giving high fives, but that's not bad.
Great.
Where do the heavy red flags come into play? Give you a side example, and I've never talked about this on the podcast. There's a missing episode, and I won't go too deep into it because it's under litigation, but there's a company, Scribe Media, and they had the best company culture, entrepreneur of the year, Javon McCormick, the CEO, best place to work for in Austin, Texas. Like, everything was amazing, and everything crumbled. Like, they weren't fulfilling client orders. They weren't paying their freelancers. Apparently, the CEO, allegedly the CEO was ultimately using his own money and like taking company money to build his personal brand. And he had an incredible message. I loved him. I saw him as a mentor. He was all about diversity. He was such a brilliant thought leader, but he was running this company into the ground. And apparently they had different things like pressuring people to leave a review on how happy they are to work there very early on into being with the company. And like, people were kind of gaslit and not part of the in crowd if they disagreed with the company culture. And all this stuff was going on behind the scenes. But when I talked to the guy, I loved him. I loved what he was doing. It seemed incredible. And now that's a missing episode because it dropped the week that he had to let go 100 employees because they were going under. And this is me just kind of thinking out loud. This is me just sharing. I don't really know if I have a clear consensus here, but it blew my mind.
You were asking about the red flags.
Things weren't what they looked like on the outside, and no one saw it. And then once it happened and people started to talk, everyone was like, oh my God, this company was a sinking ship the entire time. But no one saw it.
I think probably people did see it, but didn't know what they were looking at. And I see that time and time again. I don't know if you've seen the documentary Out for Blood in Silicon Valley about the Theranos debacle with, okay, but you know about with Theranos, right? With Elizabeth Holmes. She's the one who created the blood thing and turned out it was a big scandal. She was scamming everybody. No, you didn't ring a bell?
No. And if I don't know, the listener might not either. So give us the brief.
Okay. Okay. So basically, and I hope I don't butcher the facts here, but Elizabeth Holmes was kind of like a female Steve Jobs in Silicon Valley. And she was basically got a ton of people on board. And I want to say Henry Kissinger, like out of all these like former very high up political people to fundraise millions of dollars for an invention that she said she had and she didn't really. And she had this incredible corporate culture, kind of like Apple vibes. And it was basically, it was something to do with like being able to collect blood. Like the way that a lot of people have to get their blood work done for diabetes and all sorts of different things. She had an invention that could be like an at-home way of testing. It was a very, very small version of what they do in the lab. And it was a scan. Like basically she had an idea, but she didn't have, like, it was kind of fake it till you make it. And she just really thought it would pan out. She's, I think she's in jail right now. There's been a whole trial. It's wild.
I do know it's clicking.
The name of the company. It's coming back. Clicking. Yeah. It's a couple years old.
She had a big vision and she was getting these investors, but she wasn't actually fulfilling the product that she was telling people she would fulfill.
Yes. And actually, we're going to do an episode on it with one of the whistleblowers who's in that film in January. And that should be really, and I've been waiting because there's a trial. Like we had to wait till the trial was over. But when you watch the documentary and you know my story and you're familiar with these templates, it's very obvious watching it. There was this corporate culture, there was this rah-rah, but one of the things that was totally snuffed out was any dissent. Anyone saying, wait, I don't think like this is actually, you know, this isn't working. Anybody would just be booted. And so that's one of the red flags I always say right away. Like if you can't express questions or concerns without being gaslit. And for those people who don't know what gaslighting is, it's actually like the word of the year in Merriam-Webster dictionary last year. Wow. Is that it's basically when the person's trying to make you doubt your own reality and question yourself. So, but one of the ways it looks like is if I say, oh, hey, I'm concerned about X, Y, Z. And it flips back to me like, you know, why do you think you're being negative right now, Sarah? Or in the case of Nexium, if I had a concern, it was like, you know, Sarah, you seem really reactive about that. Like it's my issue. Like my reactivity is the problem, not the problem that I'm pointing out. And then it'd be flipped to like, you know, maybe you should go journal on that or talk to your coach. I didn't realize how suppressed I was, how I could not speak my authentic, true voice until I got out because I couldn't go up. If I went up, because you know, the pyramid structure of a MLM, if you go up, the person above you, your upline, then I would be gaslit. But if I went down, that would be like bad leadership. You can't express, you know, that like, oh, I'm concerned about this. Like I would, so I was sort of stuck where I was, not able to share with anybody.
It sounds lonely.
Terrible. It was very lonely. And I actually don't even think I even captured that in my book because it's something I haven't figured out really till even more recently, like just how much toxic positivity there was. Like I just had to be like, this is amazing. Like I'm so happy. Everything's so great. Like the tools work. I'm an ambassador for humanity. I'm an ambassador for the science of joy, which is what we taught. And that's, I've since learned is in almost all these groups have this toxic positivity of, you know, singing the gospel, doing the Lord's work.
And I think, Sarah, this is part of why I love the podcast so much and I enjoyed The Vow even like right when it started is because a lot of these tips and like a lot of it's based in neuro-linguistic programming and, you know, spiritualism and a lot of it isn't bad. Like it's not the worst advice. In some scenarios, you do want to look in the mirror and say, what part of me is projecting upon other people?
Right.
Was this actually my fault? Let's go inward and determine like what storyline or what inner child wound would be helpful to heal to move forward with grit and grace. That's not unreasonable. But when it's used where you start to gaslight yourself and there's an actual problem and it's not you in the mirror, it's the piece of shit running the operation, but you've been taught it's always your fault. Like this isn't bad advice. It's just like, it's Machiavellian the way it's being used.
Yes. It's a really, really good point because a lot of people, even the people who are still loyal to Keith, if you can believe it, they exist and they think that he's misunderstood and, you know, Nippy and I and the other whistleblowers are the bad ones and he's the good one. Like it's wild, but they were like, but the tools are so good. So many of the tools are really good. And everything you just said, yes, understanding your inner child and your trauma wound and all that stuff, projection, inner work, all that stuff is so important. Personal responsibility, so good. Clutch and super clutch, especially in all of these, you know, self-awareness and personal development groups, like take responsibility for shit. Don't be a victim. Don't put it, it's not your parents' fault. Like look internally, blah, blah, blah. Great. But when you need to point out a problem, the company needs to be like, you know, and the company needs to have a place where they can take feedback. And if you can't feel like you can't give feedback without being in trouble or being ostracized or punished or demoted, that's a major, major red flag. And in that same vein, I'd say, I actually just did a TEDx talk, which should drop literally any minute, like maybe while we were on this interview, and I'll send it to you afterwards.
We'll put in the show notes because this won't drop. This won't drop today, so it'll be in the show notes. I'm looking forward to that.
Perfect. And I try to give people like a brief overview. People like your friends drinking beer in Albany, like, they don't know anything about this. They're not going to listen to my podcast. They're not going to watch The Vow. Give them a 15-minute TED talk. Like, what's a, like a little a mini smorgasbord of understanding? And one of the things is, if you're not sure about a group and you can Google, is blank a cult? And if anything comes up, any allegations, any lawsuits, where there's smoke, there's usually fire. And there were so many allegations about NXIVM, but I'd been trained that when somebody like Keith Raniere wants to teach ethics to an unethical world, there's going to be pushback.
Right.
And what's the worst thing? What's the worst thing? And which is true. People try to do things in the world, there will be pushback. It's not the case for him. And that is actually one of the most dangerous things. There's so much truth in all these things. And there's little droplets of lies. It's really hard to discern what's what these days.
How do we discern? Any thoughts on that?
Well,
because there's a lot of things I enjoy. It's you and I joked about it. We don't have to go deep into it, but a buddy of mine created a breathwork app, and then they have bathhouses where they create emotional bonds and experiences through hot and cold therapy and breathwork, loving kindness meditations. And I'm 100,000% on board, but I'm also not in the inner circle. And I think in this scenario, they're fine, but there's situations where there's these yoga cults and there's like, I feel like it's everywhere. And I don't know how to discern, like everything I just said is a good thing. Breath work, good thing. Hot and cold therapy, good thing. Emotional bond with friends,
love all those things.
Good things. I can't, I have a negative, I don't have a single negative thing to say. So how do I discern that things might not be what they look like?
Yeah, it's so tricky. I think the first thing to know is that there's no group that is not susceptible to abuses of power. So it can happen anywhere. It can happen in a PTA group, like you saw the show, or if you've seen the show Dance Moms, where like it can happen. It happened in the military. It can happen in the government. It can happen in big pharma. It can happen anywhere. So the question is, do you know what to look for? And I would say that it can also start with great intentions. There's a lot of people I've seen, especially in the yoga community, where it sounds like somebody had really good intentions, great person, and then it blew up. And then that, you know, fame got to their head. Like imagine being a dude, which you are, and having like 50 yogically, you know, scantily dressed yoga women throwing themselves at you. I would imagine that would be quite hard to deal with an ego and the male sex drive. That's a recipe for disaster, right?
Not me,
I don't think
Sarah.
You started out. No, you're no, you're one of the good ones. But then there's people like Keith Raniere who saw people in positions of power and like specifically went out to start this so that he could manipulate people. Like people were always like, did it go awry or did he plan this? From all accounts, he started an executive success program so he could have something good that people would be drawn to, that would create dependency, that would pull people in, and he could have a harem. He could have unlimited for himself, sex, power, and money. That's all he wanted. Mostly sex.
But wasn't he celibate?
That's all he wanted. That's what we were told. I was told he was celibate. That was one of the first things I was told. I was like, why are all these women around him? Like, well, they're helping him with complete his different projects and mission, but he's celibate. He doesn't need sex because he's so evolved. Red flag. So in answer to your question, how do you discern?
Yeah.
I think it's so important. And I'm actually back on this journey because I still do love personal development and I'm a parent and I started, working on my parenting and that led me to reading some books on parenting, which led me to some workshops. And now I'm like, oh, I'm in the workshop space. Like, it's icky for me. But I'm also like, okay, not all thought leaders, not all teachers are con men or grifters or con women. You know, how do I discern? So I think one of the main things, and I said this sort of like the punchline on my TED talk, is that, like, you know, you don't need a guru. You don't need a essential oil starter kit. You don't need a, you know, $10,000 retreat. You just need tools for your tool belt. Mm. So take the tools, put them in your tool belt. Use the tools in your life. Don't make the tools your life.
Mm.
And if you were like, hey, Sarah, I'm leaving my podcast to go run the media component of my friend's bathhouse, I'd be like, okay, are you being compensated? Like, are you getting paid well? You know, do you have transparency? Like, I'd just be like, let's talk about what you're dedicating your life to. You're like, no, I'm doing it because it's like humanity and it's really important to me and I'm doing it for free and it's like not a big deal. I'd be like, that's a really big red flag, Ben. Like, don't do that. And a lot of these things start that way. Like, you're just trying to be a part of whatever it is you feel like you want to help move forward in the world, and you end up giving your life force towards something that's like not even actually your project, but you're just so love bombed you don't see how great it is. So I'd say, yeah, know the red flags. Keep your, like, use the tools. Don't throw yourself in your whole life. And constantly be getting outside thoughts. Like, if anyone's listening to this and they're like, oh, I'm in a group that, like, I realize might be a little bit culty listening to what Sarah's saying, let me go ask the leader. Like, no, don't go ask the leader. Go on the internet or go ask the people around you. Like, do you think that it's not even so much, is this a cult or not a cult? Don't worry about that. Let's get the word out of the way. Is this thing, this program, this group, this family, this club, this whatever, is it healthy for me? Is it toxic? Can I leave? Can I leave without being shunned? Like, if I leave this Orange Theory or CrossFit or wine club, am I still going to be friends with the people, or are they not going to talk to me on the street? Like, that's a huge red flag. Can you come and go? You know, that's probably a really important thing.
There's probably a big difference between I'm doing CrossFit and my buddy decides to start binge eating, not working out, doesn't show up, so I don't hang out with them because we're just doing different things in life. That's a little bit different than they're a terrible person that's toxic, and it's a good thing they're gone because they're a poison to every, like, there's a difference between separating yourself from things that aren't serving you and completely maliciously putting people on the spot as if they're, like, broken or wrong for leaving, right?
Yeah. I mean, shunning and excommunicating is a real thing. That's more in religious groups. But in Nexium, we were certainly guilty of that. Like, I don't think I shunned anybody, but I definitely was like, oh, well, I guess they're not on our team anymore. Like, I was pissed also sometimes when they left because I thought we were close. I thought we were doing this together. Yeah. I never, like, ignored somebody on the street, but they do that in the Mormon church and Jehovah's Witness and things like that.
When it seemed like, and I'll get into this with Nippy, he's going to be part two. It seemed like you guys weren't as bought in as some others. You kind of had a foot out the door, which gave you a little bit of, like, you weren't as bought in as you could have been, and I think it made it easier to whistleblow.
Yes, 100%. I think a couple factors there. One is that we didn't live full time in Albany. We did get a place there in the last 3 years when Troy was born, so we could have a place to go to. We rented out when we weren't there, but we never lived there. People that lived there and made their homes there and their lives there, that's a harder pill to swallow when you recognize that you're wrong, you know? So we always had one foot, I want to say, in reality, because I lived in Vancouver. It's far away from Albany. So I wasn't being checked up on as much. I wasn't being head fucked with as much. I didn't have every issue that I have EM'd, which I explain in the book or in the vow as well, where it's like an emotional process, like a therapeutic process to kind of change your thoughts on something, which can be really helpful and can also be really manipulative if somebody has bad intentions for you. So, and I think that they kind of also did that on purpose, even though they were really trying to get us to move there. I think they also knew, like Keith knew, that it was better for him to have me as like a pipeline, you know, like just as somebody who was getting people there. And
you're like the top, one of the top recruiters. Like, you were incredible at speaking the mission, bringing people on board,
yes,
building your own. You built the Vancouver Center, right? So,
yes,
yeah, you were kick ass. Yeah. They needed you.
They needed me, so they didn't want to push me too far.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. So they get and I was good at keeping the good stuff and not doing the stuff I didn't like. Meanwhile, pretending I was doing it all. Like, I didn't really realize how much until I left that I was, yeah, like, just took the thing, extracted the goals program and the things that I like, the community. And then there was all these other things. I was like, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing that. I didn't realize how much I was not doing and pretending to do, because I also wanted to be the good girl.
Yeah. Let's talk about the good stuff. And I know this is kind of no, in some ways. Oh, you learned something good. Like, you learned some positive tools, right? You had mentioned taking the tools, but you don't have to take in everything. Like, what did you learn that maybe you still use to this day? Did any positive come from it?
Oh yeah, so much positive. I think the only way I've been able, however, to say this is something I use is to be able to like trace it back to where it came from originally.
Gotcha.
Because Keith didn't have really an original thought in his mind.
Yeah.
he was a very good plagiarist, to the point where we found out later that, like, when he started this, he had this program called XOXO, which is so stupid. It was sort of like a yoga Pilates blend that he was trying to like create his own new style. Like, it was,
yeah,
we got in trouble for doing yoga at a certain point because I used to do yoga every day. Like, when we had to do XOXO, it was so dumb. But he found out later the people who he had hired to help him create it was literally like highlighting out of like Pilates basics and yoga basics and,
okay,
you know, physiotherapy basics, and like cobbled it together and like, this is my brilliance. I'm like, no, you're just,
well,
Frankensteined that. Go ahead.
I just feel like, don't we all extract wisdom from multiple places? The difference between someone, yeah, with humility and a total sociopath, narcissist, dangerous person is I extract wisdom all the time, but I didn't come up with it. I didn't create the, right, program. I'm not brilliant. I just read a lot. But he was presenting it as if he was creating something that didn't exist before he graced this earth, to my understanding.
Exactly.
Right? That's, yeah, the big difference. I mean, and
that is the big difference. And even like the basic tenets. So you asked me what's still good about it.
Yeah.
Some basic tenets around sort of Buddhist philosophy. There's a book called Radical Acceptance by Tara Brach that I really like. And some of the exercises in there are almost verbatim some of the things that we did in Nexium. Yeah. And I'm going to butcher this, but things like, yeah, when you're having like a reaction towards somebody and like pinpointing specifically what it is that you're reacting to, and looking almost at like how you may have also done that thing in the past, you know, and what you were going for usually has a positive intent,
like a radical empathy.
Yeah. Radical empathy. Exactly. And seeing the person as like a little kid just trying to be loved and fit in or whatever, like those kind of in the moment exercises to like not be a dick or to go from, you know, if you're angry, like go to really look inward about what's the fear underneath an anger. Something I still probably do a lot. Another one was just scripting, which is like business 101, you know, how to reach out and do an ask. Like, hey, Ben, heard your podcast, reaching out to see if you wanted to be on it with me. Not sure if you have time in your schedule, takeaway. But if you do, I'd love to connect. Yeah. You know, like how to ask for stuff in business. That was something that a lot of people did not know how to do. I still do that. It. Yeah. And in a way that's like, it's like you're not putting pressure. Like, hey, I wonder if I could borrow the blah, blah, blah. I'm not sure if you're using it on the weekend, but if you're not, like, let me know. I'll swing by. Yeah. You know, like, it's a nice way to deal with people, I think. Things like that, like little business things, emotional things, and then also very practically, because all the classes were philosophical, emotional, and practical. A lot of practical things that I'm sure he took from like 7 Habits of Highly Effective People and like things like that. But I don't know if you can see here, I have a whiteboard.
Okay.
Oops. Oh, on the wall?
Yeah.
So that's my whiteboard, and doing a whiteboard is where big part of Nexium. Like Nancy's whiteboard was like the size of her whole, like a whole basement. And she had all her, so it's like all the projects were on whiteboards with next steps and color coded. I still use my whiteboard.
And for the listener, Nancy was the president and kind of Keith Raniere's right hand lady in the operation. Yeah. And she had a background in neuroscience and NLP, correct? Like she was a smart, was a smart lady, possibly. Maybe that was a smokescreen as well. You don't know.
We don't know. We found it's out later that she, we don't know. But I mean, that's what we were told. Like she definitely had a background that gave her validity that he could kind of harness. She did teach goals programs and like Con Edison and things like that. But we don't know how much of her resume is real or not. It's like we don't know Keith's.
This stuff, again, this is why, again, a little bit culty podcast. I've been binging on it. And that's why this is so interesting to me, because when I was watching The Vow, and I only got through it one time, but I'm recalling like certain marketing tactics and like, I'm like, this is really smart. Like I can see, like I'm calling a spade here. I see what they're doing. Like as a guy who runs a marketing firm, one thing that I talk about all the time is there's no better recommendation than a third party referral, a third party testimonial, creating a tribe of people talking about you in a positive way, behind your back. And these are great strategies that work. And when you have a good product, good service, you're in the best interest for your client, and you step away when you can't help them, they're incredible strategies. But Keith was using the exact same strategies to pretend to be the smartest person in the world, to extract testimonials from the members, to get everybody recruiting each other. And again, I watched it one time, but the whole like presenting the pitch scene in The Vow when they were talking about the presentation and the takeaway and objections. And I'm like, oh my God, this is like this webinar 101 to manipulate people to buy now or else. And I'm like, shit, like this isn't bad advice for a good-willed person, but for a bad-willed person, this is toxic.
Yep. That's why I think he got so many people who are, I mean, a lot of people around him did illegal things and need to be held accountable, but no one signed up for this.
Right.
Nobody did. Nobody signed up to be Ghislaine Maxwell to Keith Raniere. And he had a bunch of them. Ultimately,
I think a bigger question, because bringing in, like, you know, you're an actress, a lot of actresses and directors and, you know, notable people were in, which helped recruit more. And like, you guys brought the Dalai Lama in and like some sort of event on Richard Branson's island. Like, let's use Dalai Lama as an example, and this might be controversial, but can the Dalai Lama just be bought? If I have enough money, will he endorse me? Like, can't he see through the bullshit himself? Why would the Dalai Lama not notice the red flags? Or can he just be bought?
I don't know for sure. So this is my opinion. Sure. But I think that there's the Dalai Lama and there is a bunch of controversy around him now, as you probably know. So we can kind of separate that out for a minute, because that's sort of being resolved or not. Will all come to light. But separate from that, like, we didn't know about that at the time. I think that I see this with all sorts of gurus and thought leaders and people in his position. There's them, and then there's the people around them. So my guess is that that the people around him could be bought, so they could get his endorsement. And that's what it appears. It appears that $1 million was gifted to the foundation, which I'm sure they could really use, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't think that he was around them enough to be able to like see the red flags. But if you see that, watch The Vow, like the Dalai Lama is like onto him. The Dalai Lama is not having the wool pulled over his eyes fully.
Yeah.
He's just,
that was a really awkward scene. Again,
so awkward.
We're kind of talking about stuff that you might not have seen. So in the show notes, The Vow is, Sarah's book is, I literally like binge on it. It's incredible. But yeah, that scene with the Dalai Lama was really awkward. That meeting felt weird. Keith looked like he had just done drugs or something. I don't, it was just like a slop. Do you know what I'm talking about? It just was a weird scene to see that interaction.
I feel like I wish I'd seen that when I was in, because what we had heard was so different than what I saw in that scene in The Vow. Like, so, and just so you know, when people watch The Vow, they're like, oh, it's so obvious. I'm like, yeah, we didn't, all that behind the scenes footage of like Keith at home with the women around him and like him being so gross and his home being so nasty and that really awkward scene where he goes to convince the Dalai Lama to come and do an appearance in Albany. All of that stuff is not, we were not privy to as outer circle or inner outer circle, outer inner circle. I thought I was part of the inner circle. I was not, because I was not part of the harem. So there's a lot of things going on behind closed doors. But yeah, in answer to your question, I think that all of these groups use endorsements like Richard Branson, like the Dalai Lama, to say like, to give a stamp of approval. And that's actually a red flag. I see it with other groups using both of those people. And Richard Branson was like, I don't even, who, NXIVM, what? Like, I don't even remember doing this when it all came out. Yeah. Huh.
You got me thinking deeply. I ask people for testimonials all the time, but I'm not ill-willed.
Yeah.
When I'm doing it.
Testimonials are, I mean, it's like we ask for reviews on a little bit culty. Like, we want people to say, hey, this is good.
You have a Patreon.
We have Patreon. People support us. And I think asking for support and asking for testimonials is not bad. It's just, if you are a con man and you can say, hey, well, Dalai Lama says we're good, it's just a lie, you know? So it's like, are you being truthful or not?
So is your Patreon even just a little bit culty or no?
It is, because it's a group. Right. That's the problem. It's a community. And we always joke, like, I mean, we try to be tongue in cheek about it. Our tiers, you know how there's like different levels that you can join? Our tiers are fanatics. Flying monkeys. No, sorry, loyalists.
Okay.
Fanatics.
Yeah.
Flying monkeys. You know what flying monkeys are?
No.
Do you know what that term's from? It's from Wizard of Oz.
Okay.
The Wicked Witch sends out her flying monkeys to do their dirty work, right? So flying monkeys in the narcissist world. So Keith didn't do a lot of his dirty work. He had the people around him. Like, Jeffrey Epstein uses Ghislaine Maxwell. She's a flying monkey for Jeffrey.
Mm.
Okay, so that everyone's got a flying monkey who's in these positions of power, right? And then the top tier of our Patreon is Inner Circle.
Okay.
So we just made a joke. It's tongue in cheek. Like, come join us in the Inner Circle. Like, what do you get there? You get a signed copy of my book and a little bit culty hat and some lip balm. Like, That's the extent of it. There's no bait and switch, right? There's no lie. Like, we're asking for money to make the podcast keep going, to pay for the production of the podcast. And in exchange, they get, you know, ad-free listening. They get early access. They get to help create some of the content. They get live Zooms. They get a bonus episode every week. They get a present. Like, they get a lot of stuff. That's an honest exchange.
Yeah.
Right. If it was, I'm actually extracting their emails and then I'm going to hit them up for something else, that wouldn't be cool.
And you're not using their support for some sick, sadistic personal reason. You're using their support to get this message to more people that are hurting, healing, or weirdos like me that just, honestly, it's very interesting just to study it from like a human behavior, sociocultural kind of perspective, and see the marketing that's happening and the sales. And this, it's just like, for me, it's just interesting as heck. And it just amazes me how interesting humankind is a simple way to put it. The fact that Keith Raniere's exist is mind blowing to me, because
well, there's a lot of them too.
Can't even imagine. Is it a chemical imbalance?
I think, based on my non-expertise and talking to so many people and researching other people like David Koresh, Jim Jones, other cult leaders, a lot of them have a very similar what's the word? Life experience. And that's, and this is, again, I'm not an expert, but
sure.
Just from my like dime store analysis,
yeah.
A lot of them did not have a very good upbringing. I don't know how much you know about attachment theory and attachment parenting, but there's different types of attachment styles. And basically the long and short, if your listener doesn't know, is like, it's like, what kind of bond do you have with your parents? Is it healthy? Do you feel like somebody's there for you? Do you feel safe? Do you feel protected? Right. Do you feel heard? And if somebody doesn't have that with one of their parents or both of their parents, it can create sort of different personalities as they grow up. And what you see a lot of is like, if a woman, for example, has daddy issues, is one way to call it. It's like not a proper psychological term, but daddy issues. they may be looking for a dad figure in their life to replace that father because they didn't have it. And vice versa with men and their mothers, and different combinations thereof. And so what I see with a lot of these men is that they didn't have proper attachment to one or both of their parents.
Mm.
And especially somebody like Keith is a real hatred of women. A really latent, or not so latent now, but I didn't see it when I was in there because it was so well hidden.
Mm.
And then combination of, so they call it a vulnerable narcissist. So certain type, there's you know, there's like over 50 narcissists, like different kinds.
Different
yeah. blends and
Makes
like
sense.
Sociopathic narcissists, wounded narcissists, vulnerable narcissists.
Huh.
I don't even know. That's not, I can connect you with some experts on that if you want to do another episode, because that's not my area of expertise, but it's fascinating. It's not just one type. But a lot of these sociopaths, and Keith actually taught this to us. And if you want to dig into this more with Nippy, taught us how the sociopath basically knows your psychology, because they used to have it.
Right.
But they also have a whole range of options of how to operate in the world that you don't have, because you have a morality. You have a good and bad spectrum.
Mm.
Right. But a sociopath is willing to lie and steal and cheat in the game of life because he can or she can. And they know that you would never do that because you're a good person. So they know that you don't suspect it.
Damn.
And did your mind look a little bit blown on that last comment? Did that, the sociopath stuff, it's pretty wild, right?
What's wild about it for me is, as a career, I've been studying marketing and sales and human behavior and psychology for quite some time. And scenarios do occur. Give you a simple example that's not malicious. I know for a fact I could sell someone something. I know based on the conversation that I could convince them to sign up with me, but I know there's going to be a churn. I know that I can't deliver based on their needs. I know it's not a good investment for them. So I, as quickly as possible, tell them that. And in scenarios, I worked for a company that told me, we don't do anything for free. Fuck that. Like if I can help them in 45 seconds and be like, set up a Google My Business profile, do this, 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 and this, you'll get momentum, then come talk to me. If I can do that, why not do that? But you're saying there's certain people that see, even if there's going to be churn, even if they're not a good fit, if you can extract $4,000 from them today, it's still worth to take their money, because why not? When I have this emotional reaction, like, I shouldn't do this, I shouldn't sell them, other people don't even have that thought process, or they notice it and they're like excited about it. Like, oh, look what I get to do. Blows my mind, because I'm not wired that way. But does that make sense?
You're a good person and you care about people. And, Keith gave us an example once about, because he taught us about sociopathy. He called it suppressive, same as Scientology, by the way. And he talked about what people take the fall, like Lucifer took the fall.
Right.
And my biblical studies are not like up to snuff, but what I understand is, I'm not even going to go there because I don't want to butcher it. But what I will say is that he talked about, he was basically like, you know, there's people in the world. He said in the world out there, they may call it, might be like a sociopath, but you can't see what they're doing because you'd never suspect it. Like, he even taught us how to look for it so that we'd never consider that he was also doing it. Right. And one of the examples he gave, he used a lot of metaphors so that people could understand different concepts or different mindsets or whatever. And he said, imagine being, well, you can do this with me for a minute.
Yeah.
Imagine being in jail. Okay. Like you're in jail right now. And you know that to get out of jail, you might have to say, murder the guards. How does that feel if you had to like murder someone to get out of jail? As a person, feel good about it, bad about it?
No, my assumption is I'm in jail because I deserve to be there. So that would be
okay.
Bullshit.
Okay, that's great. So now imagine that you found out the guards are just robots and you could be free, but all you have to do is like pull a cord or like snap a wire.
Turn them off. Yeah.
Do you feel like you have more options to get out or like do you feel like... I mean, you started with a pretty good assumption, like I did something bad, I deserve to be there. But now, like, you want to be free, and all you have to do is snap a wire.
Right.
How does that feel?
And I have, like, quick route out of the country and a place to go, and I'm innocent, and I don't need, I shouldn't be there in the first place. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let me out. Make it as like simple as possible.
Let me out.
Yeah.
Right. So he said that feeling is how sociopaths experience the world. People are just robots that they can just snap a wire and get out of their way to do whatever they want. So that's, I was like, whoa, that, because I've heard of the term objectification.
Yeah.
And how people objectify people and, you know, use people for their own devices. And that I think was such a great example to imagine what it's like for somebody who just objectifies people. I don't see you as a person. I see you as a robot that can either serve me or not serve me. Like what a terrific worldview. I know, right?
Yeah.
So how do you, and the thing is that what I've learned is that the people who like Keith, who learn this also know how to present as normal and know, and that's where they see this like charismatic leaders is that they express themselves. And this is one of the things they talk about. If you have all the options to be successful, plus a whole bunch of options that other people wouldn't take, you have all the options in the world. That's a lot of confidence. Like imagine the confidence you feel knowing that you can win because you have all these extra tools in your tool belt, including lying, stealing, cheating. So they present as exhausting. Very high confidence.
I get their confidence. Yeah. I get their living the life. It sounds so freaking exhausting to be cloaked with a lie.
Yeah, but they don't see it as a lie. They see it as an asset. I know, right? I've learned so much about this. And it also makes me so skeptical of people who have a certain kind of charisma and a certain kind of like, you know, I'm like, okay, what's really going on here? Look at their parenting, how they were raised.
It's why we need Sarah and Nippies in this world to talk about it, have authentic, vulnerable discussion, expose these lies, because it's not like there's just Keith Raniere, David Koresh, a couple of them out there, and then we're good to go. This is very pervasive, isn't it?
No, it's very pervasive. You know, you'd be surprised. Like I almost want you to put me in a room with those beer drinking Albany guys, because one thing you could say, and I appreciate you having my back, but one thing you can say is like, have you ever been duped? Like, have you ever been like, has anyone ever conned you? So many times people, especially since The Vow, which is one of the reasons why I love it so much, people are like, you know, either something as wild as, okay, thank you to The Vow. We get these messages all the time. Thank you to The Vow. I left the Mormon church. I left the Jehovah's Witness. I finally was able to break away from my extremist, fundamentalist, whatever, all sorts of different things. And then we have people who are like, you know, I was never in a cult, but, you know, I lost a ton of money to somebody I really trusted and turned out was just like milking me, you know, and they were conned and they missed the red flags because they trusted somebody. And so it's way more pervasive than I think people know. And it goes back to like, you know, basics of when you see somebody in a domestic violence situation, you go like, why didn't she just leave?
Right.
It's so much more complicated than that. Yeah.
So much more nuance,
which is why I love these conversations. And also why I love doing, like somebody might look at my podcast and like, why are you doing a business podcast? So like, because this is the Venn diagram, it overlaps right here. And there's a huge spot in the middle where your people and my people are the same people, all wanting to seek and be better and to grow and understand themselves. And that's a really ripe spot for people like Keith Raniere. So I love to be able to jump in the business conversation and try to shine light as best as I can.
And thank you for that. People are probably listeners, like frequent listeners on my show, are probably wondering, Ben, why are you doing a business podcast? And when I first started, the word connections came from on LinkedIn, you make a connection. And I had just started a company and I didn't have any connections. So I used the podcast as a way to learn from business professionals way farther along than me. But as the podcast has evolved and how, you know, I've evolved, I've learned that storytelling and mindset and vulnerability and understanding the emotions and the child work and a lot of these things that don't feel businessy are exactly the shit that you need to know to have a fulfilling life as a business professional. So conversations like this, it's not the tactical five-step sales strategy, but it works a different muscle that often is laying dormant, that we might look at our leader and be like, do I want to be a part of this team? Or is this culture manipulating me? Or maybe I Google search and am I part of a multi-level marketing setup? And if so, what's the success rate here? Not saying all MLMs are bad, but if 99% of people, why do you say, I was going to say if 99% of people aren't successful, but tell me, are all MLMs are bad just by the way that it's structured?
MLMs are always going to be, and this is one of the lines in my book, Keith Raniere, I don't know if you remember this, when he was getting me to do a pitch for something, he's like, just make sure you have a good state because you're giving them the illusion of hope. And that's why they're, and I couldn't wrap my head around that. I was like, what? The illusion of hope. That's the, all of these things are an illusion of hope.
Oh my God.
All an illusion of hope. None of it is true. And they're good for the, they're good for the 1% that start it and make a ton of money.
Totally.
But their income, I mean, they could say, oh, it's great. Look how much money I'm making. But like, look at the people you brought in. Are they making money? No. And they're not making money because they don't have the right mindset. They have, they're not making money because this compensation plan of every MLM is set up for fail, for failure. Mm. Only the people at the top make money. That's how they're set up. It's impossible. So it's a lie. It's another bait and switch. That's why I don't like MLMs.
Yeah.
I'm very loud about that. You don't have to be, but I can be. I can be the bad guy.
Please. Well, but I'm gonna for me, it's, I think about the structure and I think about some of the people at the top that are making billions of dollars and the fact that that money doesn't trickle down into bonuses and commission for not just sales or marketing, but for the accountant, the operations. If you're fulfilling orders, all the sales don't matter if you can't fulfill them. So why is all that money not trickling down? So objectively, the person who took on the most risk is going to be at the top, but I feel like the triangle is so darn narrow, like it should be as wide as possible, where the person at the top makes money, it trickles down to everybody else. And is that not, in a sense, multi-level setup? Like businesses are set up in a multi-level way just by nature.
Well, businesses by nature are usually like a pyramid. There's somebody at the top who brings in, you know, overseeing other people, bringing other people. But the MLM structure, what makes it unethical, I think, and not good, is that the compensation plan for it, for like the math to work, you have to recruit so many people to like almost all compensation plans, you're only earning a tiny percentage of what your people bring in, and you have to usually match it like on another leg. Right? So it's not just like direct, it's not like I'm selling a vacuum cleaner to you and I get 20% commission.
Right.
That it's not, it's actually much, much, much less. And you have to usually balance with another leg or a structure. There's all this sort of crazy math that goes along with it. And also for people to make money the way that they promise, they have to inflate the cost of whatever the thing is. So it's like, oh, this new mango juice or aloe vera spritzer or eye cream or hair product or whatever. It's, you know, this is like the best of the best of the best. Lies, first of all. But let's even assume it was a really good mango juice concentrate and they're saying it's worth like, you know, $100, but they're going to give it to you for 20. No, it's only worth $5. And they're selling it for 50. Do you know what I mean? So there's already, there has to be an inflation of the value of the product for the split to work out in a way for people to make money. So there's a lot of value distortions in the compensation plan and then the distortion of the value of the thing itself.
Got it. And
yeah.
And you're making money by creating this false sense of hope in recruiting other people that continue to recruit yeah. other people, but the product and service offering is not sound. It's usually it could be trash.
Yes. If you want to do a, like a more of a deep dive into MLMs, there's a guest who's been on our podcast who I love and her book's amazing. Her name's Emily Lynn Paulson. Do I have her book? It's not there. I think it's over there somewhere. Anyway, I'm happy to make the connection. She's a great interview and she can go into more details about specifically why they're unethical. Hi, sweetheart. How are you, boo? Yeah. Do you want me to set it up for you? Yeah. Do you want to say hi? You can watch in my bedroom in a minute because daddy's going to take over and he's going to do an interview next. Come here. Come see this. Well, you can't because I'm doing a podcast. No, the sound's going to make noise. Here, let me set it up. You go watch in your new bed. Okay. Want to do Bluey? And I'll be there in a minute. We'll have a cuddle. Okay. You have fun at Fernbank? Okay. B for bingo. Bingo. Bye. Bubba Bluey, that's right. Oh God, he's so cute. I should go because he's home now and I gotta go be with him and Nippy's ready to rumble with you.
Thanks.
Is there
for
anything
sharing.
Any else burning questions or
a million of them. I honestly feel like I did a disservice that I wanted to learn a little bit more about Sarah. And the one thing that's a burning question is how are you doing? How are you healing? What's new? How do you feel?
Oh, thank you. I mean, other than having whatever, it's cold or whatever, but I feel like I'm 6 years out. I really love my life. Nippy and I look at each other often and just go like, our family motto is, who has it better than us? It was looking at our lives and feeling grateful for our boys and being able to live in a new city and start fresh and have our podcast and you know, we're still the same people that we were when we started this. And obviously we bet on the wrong horse, but we pivoted to a career that's been so meaningful and so in line with who we are. And we actually get to help people now. And that's super rewarding for me. And yeah, I'm good. I do a lot to heal. I do a lot of self-care, an excessive amount, some might say, a lot of not culty yoga, a lot of hot baths, a lot of forest baths, a lot of hiking. About time in nature. I try to say no more than I say yes, which is hard for me. But yeah, I'm good. We're good. We're solid as a family, and that's really good for us.
I'm happy to hear that. I appreciate you. I know you do this for like a living now, but unveiling in letting people into your life and having the courage to stand up and speak. I can only imagine it's still difficult.
Yeah, it's definitely can be where, you know, trying at times, but overall it's still very, it seems actually purposeful. And feel it's, you know, kind of a weird road to get here, but I'm happy where I am. Yeah.
So I've got one quick question at the end, but beforehand we mentioned The Vow, we mentioned Scarred. Links to those are in the show notes. The podcast, A Little Bit Culty, which I've been binging on. Anything else we can do to support you? I know that's already three action items, but any other way that me and the listener can be of help?
Sure. I mean, I think
join your inner circle and Patreon.
Yeah, join the inner circle, get a copy of my book, I sign it and send some goodies. But I think the best way is if you listen to the podcast and it resonates, send it to people. Send it out to people who you think might be part of something a little bit culty. I think The Vow is also a great way to kind of politely deprogram somebody without saying, hey, I think you're in a cult. They're like, hey, you know, check this thing out. I just watched. Oh, and a lot of people go, oh, shit, that's really similar to what I'm doing. And when the TED Talk comes out, to share it, that would be helpful. I think that's it. Come find me on Instagram, Sarah Edmondson, and A Little Bit Culty.
We'll do the thing and reach out. Like this might always be the case, but you and Nippy are responsive. You're replying to your own messages. You're friendly. You're there to support. So if someone needs a helping hand, reach out to me and or reach out to Sarah. Final question, what should I ask Nippy?
What should you ask Nippy?
Nippy's see. Part two, guys. It'll come out
Nippy's
in a moment.
Part two.
Yeah.
You could ask him, because I want to get into this. We didn't have time. He was really good at running goals labs.
Okay.
And I think that the goals lab was because it was forte. And I think like the thing that was most relevant to business people is, and back to what you were saying earlier, like being in business, but also understanding the emotional world.
Yeah.
That's what the goals lab addresses. And I'll let him explain why. I think that might be relevant. Ask him why he didn't like V Week, Vanguard Week, and why he didn't do the mission statement or enter his coach data.
Okay.
Did you do those things?
Yeah. We'll try to get him.
Why
all
he
in.
Didn't give a shit about why he didn't give a shit about the stripe path.
Now I have to ask all this shit because the listener is going to be wanting these questions. So let's do it.
I'm sure you'll get lots of information. I hope it's not too redundant.
I kind of wanted to ask him how he managed not to beat the shit out of somebody because it seems like almost got there.
You could ask him that too. He'll love that. That's a common one and a fair question.
Sarah, you've spent more time than we planned on with me. I truly appreciate it. Go be with the family.
I will. Nippy will be Thank part you. Thanks two. Thanks for having me.
And part we'll talk two, soon. Yeah.